What does it mean to be a man? Seems there's some kind of unspoken code of silence about the topic. Regarding gender, identity roles. So what does it mean to be a man? And that will naturally lead into, what does it mean to be a woman? And what was God's design for the relationship between the two? And there's a striking similarity, both in the Srimad Bhagavatam and the biblical version. Which is somewhat allegorical, which is the way that the truth expresses itself through archetypes to those who don't have the authoritative version of Srimad Bhagavatam. So in that in that biblical version, after creating heaven and earth, land and sea, skies and heavens, for 6 days of creation, the Lord looked down upon his creation and concluded that it was good. After he created man, no, we have to follow this through to the end of this. Conclusions immediately. After creating man, God concluded that this is not good. That could be interpreted in a variety of ways. So then, from the ground of the earth, God brought forth animals and birds and plants and herbs. And he brought them all before the first man named Adam in the biblical version to see what he would call them. And whatever he called them became their name. And every species had a partner for the male, except the human. So then, in the better half of man, God created woman. And Adam's function of awarding names to all the species of life is a symbolic service of great importance. Because in sacred traditions, awarding a name meant creating an identity. And even a person's name is subject to be changed to signify a major spiritual transformation or revelation, which is acknowledged in awarding a new name or a title or even a nickname. So in naming all the animals and the plants in the birds, Adam began to wonder, what kind of animal am I? What is my name? What is my essence? And he couldn't answer it by himself. He needed a helper. And you see, practically speaking, that men often distance themselves from others by their exclusive preoccupation with their role as protector or provider, as essential as that is. Srila Prabhupada defined the roles for us. It is man's duty to offer protection to the woman, and the woman's role to offer service to the man. And those roles are mutual. And in Grihastha Ashram, we find the reflection of a spiritual dynamic originating in Radha and Krishna themselves. As revealed in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna was not able to understand himself, because he could see that his consort perceived something in him unknown to himself. And therefore the two, Radha and Krishna, had to become one, as Lord Gauranga. For Krishna to understand himself through the eyes of Srimati Radharani. That dynamic of the two becoming one is reflected in God's first institution, which is called Grihastha Ashram, where man and woman marry to become one in spirit, in essence, in purpose, and Srila Prabhupada in his personal dealings taught something never revealed in formal temple classes, and that is that a man should love his wife. Otherwise, the whole system becomes impersonal. And that was heavily emphasized in Paul of Tarsus, who was like the first GBC in biblical culture, spreading Christian teachings throughout the Mediterranean region, Asia, Turkey. And he had to counsel all the infants, so to speak, to the faith, the newly recruited members of the religion. And a lot of his counseling had to do with marital relationships. And he just kept repeating the same thing over and over through all his epistles, his letters, which became accepted as scripture in Christian tradition, where he kept emphasizing, husbands, love your wives. Wives, respect your husbands. And even in language, Sanskrit, the parent of all languages, utilizes different characters, charita, from which we derive Chaitanya Charitamrita. And those characters, charita, are male and female, to express the powers of both nature, which is Prakriti, who procreates, and the deity, the progenitor, who impregnates nature with life. In Sanskrit, the vowels are the masculine figures who can be uttered independently, whereas the consonants are female and can only be pronounced in conjunction with the vowels. And the first sound in creation, Om, is a combination of the vowel A, representing Krishna, and thus being the first letter in all alphabets, combined with his energy, his internal potency, and the jivas. Those three categories, God, nature, and jiva, combine in the original sound, Om, which explains the mystery Krishna reveals in Bhagavad Gita that of syllables or vibrations, I am Om, which is the distant vibration of Sri Krishna's flute, which conveys the music of love. The additional combination of letters forming the name Krishna illumines the heart with the nature of the soul as servant of the servant of the servant. From the very basics of biblical tradition, we have a much more refined version of the nature of Grihastha Ashram in Srimad Bhagavatam. When Maharaj Pariksit was hearing from Shukadev Goswami how the Maruts, the 49 Maruts who were born of Diti, who is generally the mother of the Daityas, yes, she is the mother of the Daityas, which are generally demons. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, as in the Bible, we have these very lengthy, sometimes just going on for chapters, of who begot who, and you want, and their names that you usually don't even recognize, and you wonder, why are so many pages of Shastra taken up with genealogy? And there's different reasons, one being to put the appearance of the saints and the Lord in context of family relationships. And even in iconography, the Ark of the Covenant, which was the deity for the Israelites, because it held the Ten Commandments, that was their deity. Stone slabs inside a golden it was kind of a crate, but it was very ornate. And it had two angels on top with outstretched wings
forming an arch
signifying how the Lord reveals himself in relationships. Which is what makes impersonalism very attractive to some, with the goal of Brahma Jyoti, where there is freedom from all the frustrations of relationships in this world. And right here in New Vrindavan, a controversy was brewing during Bhagavad Gita class in Old Vrindavan, when Bhurijan Prabhu was giving class, and Srila Prabhupada was upstairs hearing some of what was going on, enough to understand there was some controversy, regarding the topic of whether the soul can reside forever in the Brahma Jyoti. Because theoretically, it could. And philosophically, you can debate it forever. Never coming to any conclusion. And that class was not really conclusive. So after class, when the devotees went upstairs for milk prasadam, and Srila Prabhupada asked, what was that discussion all about? And they told him. And then Srila Prabhupada resolved the controversy in his typical, very simple, personal, loving way. He said, no, the soul cannot remain in the Brahma Jyoti forever because he becomes lonely. Such a destination is very attractive to those who find relationships frustrating, but we can't live without them. Sometimes it's hard to live with them. But there is an art to living, and that is revealed in Srimad Bhagavatam, in that when, after hearing this long narration of genealogy from Shukadeva Goswami, Maharaj Pariksit's attention was piqued when he heard that Diti, who's the mother of the Daityas, who are generally demons, gave birth to the 49 Maruts who became demigods. And Maharaj Pariksit asked, how did that happen? And Shukadeva Goswami explained that Diti, wife of Kashyapa Muni, and mother of Hiranyakashipu, and so many Daityas, when her son, Hiranyakashipu, was killed at the hands of Lord Nrsingadev, making him appear to be partial to Indra, meaning the demigods, that question of partiality opens up the whole chapter of the appearance of Lord Nrsingadev. Anyway, Diti became critical that the Lord, who is supposed to be impartial, has become partial, favoring Indra. And overwhelmed with grief at the loss of her son, hard to imagine how somebody has so much love for Hiranyakashipu, such is the nature of mothers. So, she was overwhelmed with grief, and she sought revenge to pacify her mind. And it's wonderful how she rationalized her ambition to kill Indra. The false ego is empowered to make you believe that you're right, even when you're dead wrong. So her rationale, what does rationalize mean? It means rational lies. So she rationalized that Indra has become mad due to his opulence. So I will relieve, because Indra is her nephew. Her nephew. So she thought, I will relieve him of his madness. Giving birth to a son who is capable of killing Indra. And in pursuance of this agenda, she began serving her husband, Kashyapa Muni, with such fake love, affection, faith, gentleness, humble behavior, submissive nature, and he became so pleased with her that he offered her any benediction she desired. And she told him, I want a son to kill Indra. And Kashyap Muni was aghast. He was mortified at the possibility of being implicated in not only a great sin, but regardless of what Indra does, and he's always getting in trouble, which teaches us so much, but he is a devotee. So it was a great sin and offense that Kashyapa Muni was vulnerable to be implicated in. So he reflected that she is simply adopting a means according to her nature. But I'm a man. I should know better. And then he was reflecting on the psychology of women. And there again, hear me through. Women are potentially quite selfish and can adopt any means to pursue their ambitions. That's the downside in the world of duality. The positive and potentially very devotional potential of women is that their psychology directs them to follow a man. So Kashyap Muni was thinking that she's not to blame. That's her nature. I should have known better to not be deceived by her false behaviors.
So the nature
reflected, okay, this is the nature of women. So I will lead her in a vow. I will give her a vow to follow, to achieve her aspiration, which was to kill Indra, to conceive a son who would kill Indra. That was her aspiration. But so Kashyap Muni gave her the Pumsavana vow, and he told her, if you follow this faithfully and very strictly for 1 year, you will conceive a son capable of killing Indra. If you deviate in any way, your son will be favorable to Indra. So she began following the vow very strictly. Now within the vow and within all the rituals was devotional service, because Kashyap Muni was thinking that by devotional service her heart will be purified and she will give up this hideous ambition. So for most of the year, she followed the vows so scrutinizingly that Indra became very fearful, understanding that his life was in jeopardy. So he came to her in disguise and began serving her so faithfully, by which he won her trust. And he was observing her very scrutinizingly, looking for some deficiency in her behavior, because the embryo was already within her to become the son who could either kill Indra or be favorable to him. So Indra's watching, and she's very strict in her vows, until one night she became a little inattentive and deviated just enough that it gave Indra the ability to enter her womb. And using his thunderbolt as a weapon, he cut her embryo into 7 pieces. But miraculously, it didn't die. The one son became 7. And the seven infants were crying. And Indra told them, don't cry. And then he cut him into seven pieces again. 49 children inside Diti's womb, along with Indra. And those 49 Maruts, they appealed to Indra, why are you trying to kill us? We're your brothers. And that brought Indra to his senses, which is very significant. That family affection has the ability to soften even the hardest hearts. Indra came to his senses, realized what he was doing, and stopped. And he forged a bond of affection with his 49 brothers, the Maruts. And then Diti woke up. And she saw Indra, who she envied so bitterly, just a few hours previous when she fell asleep, she saw Indra interacting with affection with her 49 children. She wanted one, she got 49. And they were all exhibiting such loving relationships. And she was so happy. That even when Indra went back to heaven taking the 49 Maruts with him, which is how they became demigods, Diti was most pleased. And Shukadeva Goswami told Maharaj Pariksit, this is something like your birth. Because Krishna saved you within the womb when Ashwatthama Brahmastra threatened to destroy you. So we need relationships in this world to find support and love, which is a means by which we will discover who we are and what we're capable of becoming. And that is the essence of Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. How Krishna came to understand himself through the love of his consort, which opened and revealed and distributed the treasure of Golok through the appearance of Lord Garunga, who brought that Golokera Pramadana down through Harinam Sankirtana, which is simultaneously the process by which Krishna comes to know ever deeper dynamics of himself, and simultaneously offers the means for the jivas to realize the depth of who we are and the potential that we can become. So in the purport to the later part, the later verses in this chapter, Diti vows to kill Indra, Srila Prabhupada reveals the secret dynamic of protection and service inherent to Vaishnava relationships. There he says, if the husband is sincere and the wife is faithful, then, even if one of the pair is unable, for some legitimate reason, to perform their devotional service properly, they will benefit from the other who does. Take advantage of this principle, it doesn't work.
But if you follow the principle, husband being sincere, wife being faithful, then even if one of the two becomes weak, as did Ditte, she was protected by the devotional service of her husband, which elevated her to the position like her sister, Aditi, the mother of the demigods, by her vow given by her husband being fulfilled in giving birth to the 49 Marks. And most of all, demonstrating the potency of devotional service in softening the heart and displace all our ill motives with love, compassion, kindness for one another. And that's essential in Grihastha Ashram. If you don't develop the crucial skills of mercy, tolerance, and forgiveness, you might not make it through the storms in life.
What did you say, the last part?
Mercy, tolerance, and forgiveness.
You might not make it through the storms in life.
Okay.
Now, it's a well-known saying that it takes a village to raise a child. But it's a little bit abstract because today's world is not predominantly village life. New Vrindavan was a village, was three, well, from one village it went to three. And then it became a big city. But the dynamics of village life are still available here. And with that comes the support of the extended family, relatives, seniors, because there's two ways to learn the skills necessary for survival in Grihastha Ashram. In normal traditional society, those skills are imbibed just by living in a family that's part of a successive generations of functional relationships. As that's all breaking down in the world today, we can subsidize by taking counsel from those who have developed the skills for successful relationships. Utilize, employ them in their own lives, and reap the benefit of loving relationships, which gives us the support we all need to achieve success in spiritual life and eventually to graduate from this material world and go back home, back to God. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments?
Thank you very much, Hare Krishna. I was wondering if you could discuss individuality within relationships, like Grihastha Ashram.
Very good question, thank you. The nature of individualities. The nature of individuality within relationships. is the personal factor, which is essential not only for success in Grihastha Ashram, but also for success in Krishna consciousness in general. The personal factor, which is not essential in empiric epistemology, is of absolute relevance in spiritual life. Of all the infinity of jiva souls, everyone is unique. Because without variety, there is no enjoyment, either for the jivas or for Krishna. That individuality is not only the mother of pleasure and enjoyment, it's also the prerequisite for harmony. Because if we were all the same, you'd never discover what harmony is. And when Krishna fashioned the jivas, he took an extreme risk. He endowed them with free will. First of all, the individuality. Secondly, the free will to express it. And therefore, there is protocol called boundaries, which is the means by which I can love you and you can love me. So that you don't trespass on the person's individuality, their individual needs, their individual rights. But you serve harmoniously, adjusting your individuality to that of others so that you can find harmony. And in that harmony, we discover the synergy in relationships, which reveals the spiritual dynamics and dimension of the Grihastha Ashram. It's a matter of give and take and healthy compromise that we adjust to the nature and needs of others, and they do the same for us. And it's sacrifice. Living with others is a sacrifice. But sacrifice is essential for progress in spiritual life. What does sacrifice mean? It doesn't mean you just endure it. It means you make it sacred by offering it to Krishna for his pleasure. And from that perspective, you can appreciate and eventually love the individuality of others without being threatened or suffocated by it. If we learn to serve and live in harmony, which is based on placing Krishna in the center, if we enter relationships with the intention of our own pleasure, the conflicts will consume us. If we enter into relationships for Krishna's pleasure, and sacrifice our own preference for the will of the Lord, then that individuality, which can be a source of aggravation and frustration, will transform
into the source of pleasure and delight, and ultimately serve Krishna's pleasure, because he wants to see harmony amongst his parts and parcels. And that takes, once again, the fine skills of tolerance, sacrifice, and forgiveness. And if we practice those skills, our relationships will bear fruit in pleasing Krishna, which is the purpose and goal of life. Alright? Yes.
Thank you very much, Maharaj. Thank you for taking the time to speak to us. These are very valuable points.
Thank you.
A lot to reflect on. You said something about if we enter a relationship based on our own selfish means, like we are looking for, it's basically based on our own sense gratification. You know, what can that other person provide me? Rather than it primarily being based around pleasing Krishna, which I think can come in many ways, like the selfish tendency, like maybe we're just looking for some type of shelter, and a relationship seems the most immediate, because the process of surrendering to Krishna and really feeling that sense of shelter may not always be as instant as it would be to interact with somebody who is also perceivably on the same material plane. And so, and the Bhagavad Gita explains that when we, you know, that in the mode of passion, it's nectar in the beginning and it's poison in the end. And so, if you enter, from what it seems like, is if we enter a relationship for this instant gratification or this lower sense of shelter, that seems more like the rajas. And so in the beginning it may be very sweet, and things are happening so fast, and then over time, because maybe there wasn't enough groundwork that was laid in the mode of goodness, that things start to come up that maybe we weren't prepared for. And then it starts to feel like it's becoming, that nectar is starting to ferment into that poison. And if we find ourselves in that situation, in a relationship, especially when we're in a committed relationship, and then there's more individuals who are invested in our relationship, like whether it's children or other family members who become dependent on us. So it's no longer a question of whether or not we can separate or anything, because now it's not about our individual or our preferences, but it's about considering the unit of the family. So I was wondering, what could you share with somebody in this situation where they feel like their relationship is kind of is bearing the fruit of the mode of passion?
That was a most thoughtful and comprehensive question, thank you, which covered many really significant aspects. First of all, there's a difference between separation and divorce. Separation can be a very healthy period in a relationship and can very well protect the relationship from that misfortune of divorce. Regarding the nature of mode of passion, which sees interactions as nectar only to become poison, another way to look at that is if we see other mortal beings as possessed of the power to give us satisfaction, then what we will do is to place superhuman demands upon mortal beings and crush and suffocate them in the process, which means the end of the relationship, obviously. If in the relationship we are seeking pleasure, the pleasure of Krishna's satisfaction, and that the pleasure doesn't come from the partner, it comes through the partner, from Krishna,
then
we can allow one another sufficient space to grow and develop into the actual healthy relationships that we all deep down, if nowhere else, desire. And if you look at the nature of relationships, it's very interesting because there is, and you know, I say it also in relation to the earth, to agriculture, that it's the same thing in marital relationships, that there's potentially a stage called infatuation, when the other person is just so beautiful and attractive and perfect, that even though they're out, even their outstanding flaws are just embellishments.
Yeah.
It's a kind of intoxication.
Yep.
Like all intoxications is short lived. I mean, it may live for a year, but when it ends, it becomes the exact opposite. Every little thing becomes such an outstanding fault. So, you know, that's the root nature of motive passion. It seems like nectar, and then it becomes poison. But Grihastha ashram means a spiritual institution for cultivating love for Krishna. If that is the foundation and the goal and the aspiration, and you understand that spiritual life means sacrifice. Bhagavad Gita, in the beginning of creation, I brought forth generations of men and demigods and blessed them with sacrifice by which you can become happy, truly happy. On a much deeper and higher level than the infatuations of passion and romance of mundane relationships, Grihastha ashram means a spiritual institution for making progress in devotional life. And it's based on sacrifice. Sacrificing your own personal preferences for the sake of others. Beginning with spouse, extending into children, expanding into family, at which point the relationship becomes more and more an obligation of duty, when the stability of others is dependent on your own relationship with the person closest to you on this plane, which is spouse. When somebody's that close to you, they see everything. If you try to hide, it doesn't work. For trust, openness, honesty is essential for building faith. And you'll find that if you can be very honest
And this is hard for men to tell their own story. Women don't seem to have that weakness. But for men, if you learn, or maybe it's a matter of finding the relationships where it's safe to share your story, and also to hear the other's story, that can engender love and trust. And then it expands. We have to share our stories with our children. And we need to hear their stories. If we want that love and trust to develop, we have to be honest. And in Grihastha Ashram, when you're living that close with someone, you're going to see everything. And even something they don't see, they're going to figure out. So be honest, be humble. And loving means you put somebody else's interest above your own. And that's the sacrifice of Grihastha Ashram. And it bears fruit in actual loving relationships that helps us cultivate our original relationship with Krishna. So once again, don't look at another individual like they are going to satisfy your deepest needs. They may be an essential component of that dynamic. But if you think that that person is going to do it for you, you're placing superhuman demands upon mortal beings, and you will crush and suffocate them in the process. If you simply acknowledge that our satisfaction comes through a loving relationship with Krishna, and Krishna works through his parts and parcels. He teaches us how to develop loving relationships with those he puts in our proximity so that we can progress in selfless service and sacrifice to please and come closer to the source of all love and pleasure, which is Sri Krishna himself. All right?
In extra instruction, Rupa Goswami said, when you enter Grihastha Ashram, it's for the purpose of procreation. So as devotees, if you enter Grihastha Ashram and you decide not to do that, are you truly practicing the ashram? Is it truly pleasing to Guru and Krishna?
Srila Prabhupada sanctions some marriages for purposes other than procreation, meaning support. But that's the exception, not the rule. The rule is that Grihastha Ashram is for the purpose of procreation. And there again, if you seek procreation for your own pleasure, it can be a miserable experience. If you offer that activity as a service to Krishna, then you find a real pleasure in what the activity offers. What does procreation mean? It means you're for creation. There again, back to the same chapter, Ditti vows to kill Indra. Shukadeva Goswami explains that at the dawn of creation, it's the real version of the biblical reflection. In the beginning of creation, Brahma created mankind. He saw that men had no interest in procreation. Which means the creation can't go on. So, Krishna created a woman. Of helping man in the service of procreation. And he endowed that service of procreation with certain pleasures to entice people to take it up and to mitigate the miseries of the experience. So there's some legitimate pleasure in procreation. But if you seek the pleasure divorced from the purpose, it becomes sinful activity. So what is the real joy and satisfaction found in procreation? You are participating in the vast joy of a wonderful world perpetuating itself by Krishna's design. But if you try to seek the pleasure of relationships divorced from the purpose, you'll experience only an illusion wrought with miseries and no real satisfaction.
My second question is, when we take initiation and we vow our four regulative principles, one being no illicit sex, what does that mean in Grihastha Ashram, and what if we vowed to follow that, and what are the consequences of not following that?
It means sex only for procreation after the appropriate sacrifice of Garbhadhana Samskara. Anything other than that is, to some degree or other, illicit. And the consequence will be aparad means distance from Radha, which means the process of worship. The consequence is that there will be distance from Krishna by violating our vows.
One mango.
All right.
So that means chanting 50 rounds and following the Garbhadaksha Samskara. And so the subtle levels of that with affection between a husband and a wife, what does that mean and where are the boundaries?
Well, the boundaries are what's legitimate. As Srila Prabhupada said, same thing Paul says, husbands love your wives, otherwise it becomes impersonal. But it doesn't, the boundary is, at what point does it become an indulgence? Indulgence separates us from Krishna. Showing proper affection to others, be they family members or friends or whoever, that awards one of the most tangible, immediate experiences of relationship with Krishna through his parts and parcels, just by showing proper affection. But the boundary is, when does that become exploitation? That we're using the other for our own pleasure. Proper showing of affection is to give pleasure to another. We exploit that for our own selfish, and you naturally receive pleasure in return. It's natural. But if you exploit others for your own pleasure, and usually in the name of affection or so-called love, it's, you know, unfortunate that the word love, which used to be a sacrament, has become one of the major items for exploitation by the advertising industry to promote selling of their products. And in this culture of death, and if that seems harsh, then just look at the statistics since Roe v. Wade. 63 million children butchered in the womb. Now, in barbaric societies, that was considered a capital crime. Not all, but some, because they understood procreation was necessary for civilization. So it's a culture of death, modern so-called society. And when the word love is capitalized by the commercial industry to increase sales of products, and 63. Look at the imagery. What it means. There are clinics where ladies can go to become freed of the responsibilities of having a child. And they're very sterile facilities where there's a table draped in white. And the man is like a priest, all dressed in white. And he performs his sacrificial rite. Which is accepted as legal.
Mike Mahar.
In very graphic terms, the abortion clinic is a place of the epitome of the culture of death, because on a white table replacing the altar of sacrifice, presided by, they call them doctors, all dressed in white, sacrificial offering is an unborn child, all in the name of progress. It means not only have we regressed to the barbaric days of child sacrifice, it's much more hideous than that. It illustrates the death of the whole earth process, which is procreation. So therefore, Grihastha Ashram has its sacrifice in Garbhadhan Samskara to attract a worthy soul to enter the womb so the husband and wife can practice the sacrament of serving the servants of the servants, in which case all family members become purified in the process. And children become a blessing to the earth.
My question.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's been a few variation in thoughts and opinions with regards to how long two people should associate with one another before entering or getting married and trying to practice Grihastha Ashram. Is there any guidance, rules or regulations that we should observe in our association, in relationships prior to marriage?
Well, I wouldn't put so much emphasis on institutional guidelines as I would the wisdom of experienced devotees in the art of relationships and how they would evaluate the maturity of a relationship in terms of when it would be sanctified by marriage. Requires tremendous maturity to enter into a marital relationship. Takes tremendous maturity to enter into a marital relationship and be fruitful in that Grihastha Ashram. It's not just entering it, not surviving it. It's
serving it.
What?
Serving it. Serving Krishna.
Continuing it. Counsel is essential at all steps. Those who have experienced it, they've been through it, they know it, they know the indications for better or worse, and how to guide one through those challenges. That's the role of, normal world is parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles. There's a lot of wisdom gleaned in the process. And those who have achieved that wisdom are eager to share it with others. Simply have to reach out and ask for it. And of course, prayers and blessings are always essential and should be beseeched at all samskaras, at least. Every opportunity, beseech prayers and blessings of others for success on our journey.
Thank you so much, Mahara. A few questions. First one, what does it actually mean that the husband needs to be sincere? Would you elaborate on that? And the faithful, it's kind of easy, you know, the wife needs to be faithful. It's kind of easier for me to grasp that.
It means simply his main desire is to please Guru and Krishna.
So that's not a qualification for the husband. That's a guru. That's any devotees should do this. To me, that's...
Yeah, but there's different levels of that, which is called sincerity. Sincerity means that aspiration to please Guru and Krishna overrides egotistic, sensual, other aspirations.
So what would be the other qualities besides sincerity for the husband?
Well, they're mutual. Srila Prabhupada emphasized husband, sincere husband, faithful wife. But the husband also has to be faithful. Wife also has to be sincere. And, okay, back to the two genders and what are the requirements. Women need protection. And it it's a very controversial reality, so easily misunderstood. Men are wired in such a way as they need respect. And of course, everybody's going to say false ego, and it's not necessarily that. It's Krishna's design. And of course, you see it most vividly in places like the military. That functions based on respect. Not necessarily for the man, but the uniform. And there's a hierarchy. So in this world, there's a hierarchy, beginning with Krishna, and then coming down through the devas, and then, you know, the shamans and brahmins here on earth. And if you honor the hierarchy, which means respect, then you're the recipient of all the blessings and benefits in this world.
But that's, again, wife's quality to be respectful towards husband. More about what the husband's qualities in relation to the wife.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Husband's primary duty to protect the wife. Now, okay. What does that mean? You know, it means physically, emotionally, financially, and in every way. But here's the glitch. If you think that, oh, he needs respect, that's false ego, I will withhold it, then what you're really withholding is his natural inclination to give the wife protection. I've seen it. Man wants to give protection to the wife, but if she's disrespectful, he naturally withholds it. And then the aggravation and the criticism and the disintegration just escalates. A man can't offer protection if the gesture is not respected. Well, maybe he can if he's exceptional, but it's not normal. But all these things are mutual. I mean, the man also has to respect the wife, and the wife also has to protect the husband. It's just that, you know, the different genders have different magnitudes of the particular services, but they're mutual. Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, the wife is like a fortress to protect the man from illegitimate relationships. So women also get protection. And a man has to respect his wife if there's to be any relationship. But the different genders are wired in such a way that they have greater requirements for this particular needs and exchange. But they're all mutual. And, you know, the respect offered to the man should be in proportion to the respect he offers to his superiors, especially to Krishna. And, you know, normal societies, the man leads the family in spiritual values. One of the frustrations I've heard from ladies is when they have to shoulder that responsibility of being the spiritual leader for the family. It's noble that they offer that, but it's not normal that they would have to. And it definitely challenges their ability to respect the man if they have to fulfill his role. Yeah, Krishna designed the different genders. You know, man functions well with respect. Female functions well with protection. And when the exchange is healthy, the dynamics are fruitful, and the satisfaction is high. Mm.
So I didn't know that there was going to be anything up here, but when I saw you, I figured why not come. But it seems like it is a specific, topic. But you know, I am sitting here as someone who was married at one time, and and I remember when my former husband wanted to leave New Rindavan. You know, of course, my seniors that I traveled on Sangirtan with and all that was like, okay, you have to stay back, you got to talk this out, you know, you have to do all these things. And so I had a conversation. I stepped out on the road and Bhaktipad was passing by. And so I told him a really quick version of what was, transpiring. And so he asked me a very simple question. And he said, do you feel protected by him, by your husband? And I thought about it, and I said, no, I feel protected by a devotional service. And he said, Jai, then go on with your service. Right? So, I think that even though, whatever the... So anyway, that's how it worked out for me. and the other thing that I noticed also, you have husband and wife, they come together and maybe they don't really get to know each other's ins and outs too well before a child comes along. And then that's another entity that needs to, where they're trying to figure out how this is all going to work, right? And sometimes I feel like on the mother's part or the wife's part is that they can lose a sense of self, right? Because now it's, you have someone attached that's feeding from my body. I have someone that I need to feed his mouth too while I'm feeding, whatever the dynamics are. So what would you say in order for a woman, a mother, or, a wife to be able to juggle so many and still be true to her own journey or her own self?
You mentioned such a crucial component there in losing your sense of self. And it's not a sign of healthy relationships. It is a sign of boundaries being obscured. Boundaries are the means by which I can love you and you can love me, meaning one another. And boundaries have to be kept flexible, because as faith and trust develops, then the distance that you need to feel secure can be reduced. But never to the point that the sense of self is obscured when we enter into codependent relationships. That is not healthy. And the protection is boundaries. Boundaries are for the sake of protection. Protection of identity, protection of property, needs. So, back to your other part about, I'll just paraphrase, rushing into relationships, especially to the extent that children appear before the maturity has developed in the husband-wife relationship to accommodate another relationship. There again, in normal cultures, they have their systems. The immediate family, the extended family, the village, the spiritual, the religious institutions, the elders, the seniors, they all it adds the protection of the discernment and the wisdom of those who have gone before, who can identify the signs, healthy or unhealthy, to determine the pace of the relationship
that by the time children appear, there would be enough maturity, enough identity between the husband and wife that another individual isn't going to overly challenge the system on the one extreme, and preferably
do what the system's supposed to do. The children are a supreme blessing. Not supreme blessing, but amongst them.
You know, we discussed that last time, but we didn't really conclude that, okay, lest you be like children, you cannot enter the kingdom. Okay, obviously we need children around to maintain our connection with our own inner child and our own feelings. And we don't get so serious that we shut down on our giving of kindness, care, and love. And children can help protect us from those deficiencies. They do. But the relationship has to be sufficiently mature before the children arrive that the American institution isn't overly stressed. Because the stability in the husband and wife relationship is going to be the foundation for the child's healthy development and finding confidence and hope and trust and love in life. So it's back to the same thing. Grihastha Ashram is an institution with all the healthy rules and regulations to protect all members, husband, wife, children, to protect them so that they can develop in a healthy way with healthy boundaries and healthy relationships. Because all these relationships reflect, to some degree or other, our relationship with Krishna. And the issues we have with others, it's not so much between us and them as between me and Krishna. And this other person has come along like a mirror to reveal the truth to me. And if I'm not humble and forgiving, I might not be able to receive the message very gracefully. Conversely, if you are humble, I'm grateful for truth. But not the letter of the truth, that you're a rascal. Well, it may be true, but truth divorced from kindness is brutality to some degree or other, and therefore will not be well received. So, before you give the truth to someone, consider, is it kind? Is it loving? Is it necessary? Is it timely? Which are different categories of evaluating. If the spirit of truth we're delivering complements the letter of the truth. The letter of the truth divorced from the spirit of the truth is Pharisaic, legalistic. And practically speaking, you'll see in religions and spiritual institutions, you know, the nature of our relationships is very much based on our concept of God. And so much of the abuse in the Western world is based on the biblical version of God, the supreme creator who judges his creation and souls according to the law, the Ten Commandments. That kind of God archetype is very attractive to controlling, judgmental souls who want God as the authority for their behavior. Gaudiya tradition has a high emphasis on the feminine nature of the divine, which is grace, which is gentle, kind, compassionate, loving,
you don't want to go too much to the extreme of the Shakta either, because that is subject to sentimentality. Once again, healthy relationships are greatly nourished by a healthy understanding of the interaction of the male and female natures of the divine. And that explains why, you know, people can muster up enough humility to, you know, that you can tell them that you're wrong about this or that or the other thing. What makes people most defensive is if they feel that you're attacking or undermining their concept of God, because that's the foundation for their whole worldview. So, ISKCON means the service of helping people understand proper relationship, first of all, in the male and female divine, and from there, all the relationships within it. So true, devotional service is a real protection. And if the husband represents that principle, that can be a good relationship.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you so much for the wonderful, nice points. Really, we need this. So, the question is like, you said a point where, you know, it's the relationship is all about also sacrifice. The husband has to sacrifice some things out of way for the...
Most of all your time.
Yes, mainly. Right? So, that's what
made it... Most precious commodity for sacrifice.
Exactly. And at the same time, I also see, you know, wife also does a lot of sacrifice for the, you know, husband and the kid, especially because she gives the whole. So the thing is, as you said, you also have boundaries. Each one has their own individuality and boundaries. So what is kind of, you know, what is a healthy sacrifice? You know, I mean, if it goes beyond a certain limit, then, you know, you need also need, kind of, for example, as I said, time. You also need some spiritual time to, you know, what to say, strengthen yourself spiritually. Otherwise, how do we lead, you know, the family? So how do we get these, you know, what's the fine line of how much we are going, or are we going beyond it? And also see to that the wife is also not doing too much. Helping
the boundaries, it takes
something.
The gauge to monitor the health of this principle is how we are feeling closer to Guru and Krishna, which also means closer to everyone and everything. So you have to develop that inner discernment to be your gauge. Is this adjustment of the boundary bringing us closer to Krishna or further from Krishna? Is it actually devotional? Is it exploitative? Is it abusive? And, you know, false ego is empowered to convince you you're perfectly right even when you're dead wrong. So, but you can't fool those who know you possibly better than you know yourself. Therefore, counsel is essential in discerning if these, because boundaries have to be flexible to be healthy. And sacrifice has to be healthy to be fruitful. But the discernment to monitor our ongoing process will be in the wisdom of our counsel, and therefore seek good counsel. And, you know, that means both spiritual and practical, you know. Matters of Grihastha Ashram are especially the experience of those who have been through it successfully. And they're generally very eager to share their wisdom, insights, realizations. take advantage of that. That's Krishna's system. More esoteric spiritual principles you might consult with someone else. The Krishna consciousness is a blend of the practical and the esoteric. Krishna consciousness is a holistic perspective where everything in the environment is adjusted properly through Guru, Sagar, Shastra, and just our association. That will shed light in areas where we have blind spots. And it's essential to take advantage of that. And that will clarify most, if not everything.
Thank you so much, Mother.
Thank you. Yes.
So say, practical Maharaj, what that mean?
What's that?
The practical and esoteric, you said. It's the balancing. Krishna consciousness is about both. We are addressing both. So wouldn't be the practical meaning, like the human, our humanity. Like somebody said that we have the divinity, we have the spiritual, the esoteric, our spiritual life. But then we have, as you call it, practical, or I would say, the human part of us, where we have the relationships and different things going on, more on a human level. Or
and in Srila Prabhupada, you see that perfect integration. That perfect Krishna consciousness integrated with a very natural awareness of the human condition. He's the perfect integration of all those dynamics, which is really what Krishna consciousness means.
Isn't it by going through those, I call it human experiences, we are preparing for our going home back to Godhead, to practice, because it's like a, what's the word? It's perverted. Or
yeah, the human experience is part of your purification. Mm-hmm. And progress. Therefore, we don't want to become impersonal. Because that separation from all the blessings and wisdom of those who have learned from the human experience and know how to adjust it and guide it.
You said about the sacredness of the marriage, of a marriage is in offering it to Krishna, for the pleasure of Krishna. So, and I was always thinking that part of the sacredness is not breaking the vows, right? But then it needs to, if we offer something to Krishna, it's for his pleasure, it needs to be pleasurable. So it's almost like our duty to try to make it work, because if that's what's happening, Krishna is more pleased, and that offering is, am I thinking?
Trying to make it work is one of the most essential components of the sacrifice.
Because that's what's, so I'm trying to understand the sacredness of it, like, you know, if we just like, I'm going to go through it, and that's, is that sacred? You know, that's not going to be a pleasing to Krishna.
No, and practically speaking, if you're not peaceful, your benefits from spiritual life are compromised. I mean, reasonably peaceful. If you're not reasonably peaceful, it's going to make it more difficult to assimilate your Krishna conscious lessons, or even your sadhana. It's compromised and overly challenged if you're not relatively peaceful. Doesn't mean avoiding conflict, it means knowing how to benefit from it as opportunity.
So is my thinking correct here, that the more we are making it harmonious, the more that offering is paying for Krishna.
Yes.
But don't put too much emphasis on making it harmonious, and too little emphasis on letting the natural harmony come through. Harmony is something you can't force. Yes, that's what Krishna wants. That's what Sankirtan means, harmony. All these diverse individuals coming together and harmonizing on the one thing that we all have in common is that we come from Krishna. And then these individual quirks become embellishments rather than threats.
I'm really happy that Mother Madre asked that question because it makes me think about what I had asked about when we were following that particular regulative principle in Grihastha Ashram. It is obviously very, very difficult sometimes to follow it. And I think what I picked up from Mother Madre was that if you try to rectify it, is that not as pleasing to Krishna than to kind of be remorse that you're struggling with it?
Yes, that famous darshan right here in New Vrindavan. One devotee asked Srila Prabhupada about, what do you do if you're not fouling your vows? It's very interesting, and there again, you know, the personal darshan reveals so much that you might not pick up on in a transcript. What do I do about not following my vows? Was the gist of the question. And it was really interesting because Srila Prabhupada, he wasn't sure that he was understanding the question. He kept asking, what do you mean? Because the concept of not following your vows was so incomprehensible to him. He didn't know that he was hearing the question properly. So he kept asking until he understood what the person was saying. I'm not following my vows. So his first response is, what kind of gentleman, which also means lady, to take a vow and not fulfill it? So first of all, you know, we're seeing this kind of incomprehensible to him that people would take vows and then not following them. So when he finally understood that he's hearing the question properly, after his commentary, you know, what gentleman or lady would take vows and not perform them? His summary was a one-word response, rectify. And he said it with some force.
I just want to make sure I did understand it properly, that you mentioned to me that don't take to your vows. It's that you will advance better if you don't, if you can't follow your vows, it's better you don't take initiation, because you will do better spiritually if you don't vow and if you vow and break
exactly.
them.
Exactly. You can make tremendous progress before initiation. If you take vows and break them, you disqualify yourself. Much better off not to take them until you're sure you can fulfill. But then, don't look at vows as something dreadful, or regulative principles as something constraining. Regulative principles of freedom, as Srila Prabhupada explained, are also cognitive principles. It's what it takes to assimilate the holy name. But we only say the most, you know, graphic aspects. No eating meat. Well, it's not simply a dietary limitation. It means any kind of unkindness to anyone is violating that principle to some subtle degree or other. No illicit sex. looking upon the other gender with exploitative enjoying spirits. Gambling, anything that's risking your spiritual life. Intoxication means anything that makes you too full of yourself. Eating, drinking, sleeping, mating, defending, whatever. The cognitive principles that protect our Christian consciousness. And if you take the vows seriously, then everything in creation aligns to help you fulfill it. So it's the most desirable thing that, as you said, should not be taken until you're confident you can uphold it. It works against them. Krishna is very tolerant of accidental fall down. No such tolerance for intentional, perpetual, or patterns of fall down.
One more thing, Maharaj. What was...
Again, I think I missed the story about Kashyapa and Diti. What were the points there you were trying to convey from that story to us?
A lot of different points. Yeah.
So what were like some of them?
Well, there's a very outstanding comment that Srila Prabhupada is taking it from.
There's the water, Maharaj.
It's very outstanding dynamic Srila Prabhupada is revealing in that chapter. And it comes right at the end, where he makes that classic statement. If the husband is sincere and the wife is faithful, then even if one of the two is deficient in their service, and you could take that to be like, you know, okay, one of them is so critically ill that they can't, whatever. If the other is outstandingly sincere.
Say,
I mean, I've experienced myself, you know, days when I was unconscious for 24 hours or more. And then you come back to consciousness. I didn't chant my rounds yesterday. So, you make it up. But maybe somebody, you know, falls unconscious and they don't come back to consciousness, so they're not chanting their rounds. I mean, they may be doing it in their mind or heart, but physically they're not chanting their rounds. If the spouse is sincere, and part of the sincerity means you utter a sankalpa, you express an intention that your devotional service will subsidize for where that person is deficient, then that's what happens, and that's what you see in the case of Kashyapa and Diti, that she was faithful, he was sincere. And because he wanted to protect them both from that undesirable intention to kill Indra, Kashyapa Muni, his intention was that her heart be purified. And she wasn't in a frame of mind to accept instructions on devotional service at the time, so he gave her the pumsavana vow, which was the enticement that she could have her aspiration fulfilled, and within it was his instruction for devotional service as part of the vow, and his intention being that her heart become purified by that devotional service, that she would let go of that undesirable aspiration.
I find
I find it also interesting that he didn't say no to her. Like, right. You know, he didn't try to convince her this is really wrong. Yeah. But he did it in an indirect, like...
He worked with her.
He worked with her.
Or, you know, the common saying that, you know... Everybody loves to repeat, God loves us as we are. They forget the other half of the verse, that he loves you too much to leave you there. So, anyway, the most outstanding element in that chapter to me is Srila Prabhupada's statement. If one partner is unable to fulfill their vows, on the condition the other is exceptionally sincere and has that sankalpa, that intention to help, then the spiritual energy subsidizes the weaker party with the powers of the greater. But you can't just expect a spouse to come through like that, for you if you don't make investments in your account all along the way. Okay, I've got a banking account. I don't have anything in it. I'm not putting anything in it. So when I go to make a withdrawal, what's going to happen? There won't be anything there. Well, it's the same with a spouse. If you're not investing in them on a regular basis, then when you come to make the withdrawal, there won't be anything there. Therefore, daily, consistent encouragement. Kindness, support, and then when your time of need comes, it'll come back to you with interest. That's the dynamics of Grihastha Ashram. I mean, it's not limited to marital relationships. You know, brahmacharis can do it for one another. The additional potency is in the vows of marriage. We can make those vows. There's additional blessings and potency in that ashram to benefit. You know, because I can choose my friends. I may be there for you, but if I change, then I won't. But when you make the vow, you can't change that. You're stuck. I mean, you're committed. So that commitment attracts special empowerment that's not available to you know, brahmachari. Take it or leave it. There again, it's the potency in vows. It activates all the energies of the universe to align and fulfilling and helping you to achieve your inspiration. I hear too much vows, something to be dreaded. Something to be embraced if you're desiring true peace, love, harmony. Embrace your vows and they'll empower you to achieve the impossible, otherwise impossible. But there again, that's still too much to emphasize. Don't take them prematurely or worse against you. Before you take your vows, cultivate the character. Uphold them, then everything will be very progressive. And there's tremendous satisfaction found in progress, even if a lot of other things go wrong. So therefore focus, wear those little indications of progress and celebrate them. And then that's what you'll be giving your energy to. Okay, thank you all very much.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Oh,
Ananda Kumar.
Ananda Kumar. Maharaj is calling.
Where is he?
Well, it can happen later. It doesn't have to be now.
It doesn't look like he's here. Hi, Krishna to you.